Hello and welcome back to the How the Race Was Won podcast. I'm Dane Cash.
I'm Cosmo Catalano.
I was going to like set you up. I was going to say
sorry.
Who you were.
I'm sorry. It's been a long week.
You're a bike
week.
Racing analyst extraordinaire. The people got to know that.
There's been a lot of bike races to analyze.
There really has.
There's
been multiple classics. We had a World Tour stage race. We're in the thick of the classics. And yet at the same time, one Tadej Pogacar is off doing stage racing things. We have lots to talk about. We have lots to be serious about and to discuss how races were won. I think, there were six, count them, six World Tour races in between the last show we had and right now. And I, Dane Cash, and bike racing analyst extraordinaire Cosmo Catalano are going to tell you how they were won. Well, how some of them
were
won.
We're going to move quickly, I think.
Yeah, we're going to. So here's the thing. Brugge di Panna, middle of the week. You know, if this were any other week, we might give you a full breakdown. Cosmo might tell you exactly how the race was won. But we got other things to talk about, because after Brugge di Panna, both men's and women's, we had a men's E3 on Friday. We had men's and women's Gent-Wevelgem on Sunday. And we had Volta Catalunya. Again, that's six races. So we're going to tell you how three of those races were won. We're going to go in depth on three of them. We know that Wheel Talk is going to go in depth on Gent-Wevelgem. So you'll have that in just 24 hours as well. And as for Brugge di Panna, with apologies to Jasper Philipsen, who added to his tally of classics wins this year on the men's side, and Elisa Balsamo, who did the same on the women's side. That's pretty much all we're going to say about it, I think. We'll reference it as we talk about E3 and Gent-Wevelgem, but those are the races we're really going to break down. E3, Gent-Wevelgem, and the Volta a Catalunya. That's what we have on tap this week. I'm very excited to talk about it.
Spring Classics, man. Come on.
It's Spring Classics season.
It's the best time of the year.
It's a great time of year.
Christmas in April and March, because it's still March. But it's almost April.
Before we get into it any further, I just would like to remind you, listeners, that it's you, listeners, who support what we do here at Escape Collective that make this podcast and all the other shows on the network possible. Shows like Placeholders and the aforementioned Wheel Talk and Geek Warning and the Performance Process. All possible because of our members.
Process.
If you are not a member, please head on over to escapecollective.com/join and become part of this very cool community. We chat about racing on Discord while it's happening. We've got a pretty great group of people, and we would just love to have you if you're not one of us already. And if you are, well, thanks for listening to that whole spiel. We appreciate you. All right. After Brugge di Panna, after Jasper Philipsen won Brugge di Panna for Alpecin de Koenig, that same team went into E3. Not Harald Becker, not Price, but
Saxo Classic. Saxo Bank, just Saxo.
Just Saxo. But it is a bank.
Yes, I believe it's the same entity, and they've just kind of decided to call themselves Saxo.
Yeah, better. It's a slightly shorter
name.
They might
offer non-banking products, actually, now that I think about it.
Yeah, probably. We could talk about how the bank marketing was done.
Like a great new podcast.
It sounds like a great placeholders topic. We did have a whole sponsorship talk last week. Alpecin de Koenig, yet again, came away with a win.
In a
very different fashion. Yeah, what's the headline here, Cosmo Catalano, bike racing analyst extraordinaire, about the 66th edition of the E3 Saxo Classic?
I would say that there are no cobbled gutters at altitude. That would be my cryptic headline.
That's a really good, if you got the context, if you know what you're talking about, I like it.
It's for those in the know. The headline is Matthew Vanderpool is, you know, Tadej Pogacar for one day racing. I mean, he was dictating terms of the event from very early on. Trek challenged him and challenged him well, I think. And he just was continually able to really make big attacks, break up the group. And then when he decided it wasn't the right time, he would sit up and no one was really able or willing to try and counter him. Then we came in kind of the meat of the race, the Paterberg Eau de Quermont combo we know and love from Tour of Flanders. And Van Aert slipped on a gutter right as Vanderpool was already attacking. I don't think there was too much drama about attacking a guy who crashed there. And that was an insurmountable advantage. It looked for a brief shining moment like Van Aert was going to come back. He was reeling in time and they hit the next climb. And that was, you know, he started losing a second or two, then 5 seconds. By the end, Vanderpool almost 2 minutes up. Van Aert actually got caught by Jasper Stuyven, didn't even contest the sprint for second, just rolled across for third. But I mean, all the Mathieu van der Poel you can handle in one day right there in full effect on display.
I like the way that you framed him kind of dictating this race. It really, you don't really expect that in a 1 day race. I mean, you shouldn't be able to do that in a 1 day race, especially not when you have a Wout van Aert in the field. You're supposed to have a real challenger in Wout van Aert, Mathieu van der Poel. But in this race, he seemed to be a cut above. And then when we might have seen Van Aert contest, you know, in that critical moment, we'll never really know what kind of form he had on the Paderberg because he slid out. And, you know, I think you got to give him credit for getting back up quickly, working his way through the peloton, mounting a chase that was kind of disorganized at first. And then,
a show of it. He didn't panic. He reacted to that, I think, exactly the way you want to. He, like, first thing he did was when he got back up was put his bike in a reasonable gear. Because you come into that climb super fast. It's really steep. If you're not going 25 miles an hour, you need to be in a much smaller gear. And he made that correction. He used the wheels to get back up. And like I said, there was a window there. It was like, oh, man, he's going to catch him. This is amazing. And then poof. So it was also cold and rainy and got colder and rainier as it went on. So like kind of a tough race, like a lot of that really sort of solidifies the time gaps a little bit. You know, it's a lot easier to kind of have that time in your pocket when the weather gets crappy than it is to continue to perform as the weather gets crappier and crappier and you get tighter and tighter.
I think in terms of like the mental side of it, it also to me makes it more impressive that Van Aert kept trying. Yeah. He failed in the end. I was really kind of hoping that we were going to be able to talk about on this podcast, the 4D chess move of intentionally going down in the gutter just to force Vanderpool to attack. And then, you know, after Vanderpool had wasted all that energy, but no, that's not what happened.
Nope.
And in the end, despite his best efforts, he actually didn't even finish second. It was, as you said, it was Jasper Stuyven came past and there wasn't really any contest for second. It was clearly though, Mathieu van der Poel's day. I think even if Van Aert hadn't crashed, it seems like Vanderpool probably wins, but we'll never know.
Yeah. I mean, I was a little I don't want to say Visma rode poorly. They rode well. Jorgensen was up there in the mix. He was useful when there was a way to use him. I don't think there was much if it's a chase down Vanderpool, and you can't go Vanderpool fast, you aren't that helpful. But yeah, you know, it wasn't the Visma we saw at Umlopet-Nieuwsblad. We still have another week until, you know, things get for real. So they've got some time. Maybe they're coming in a little overtrained. I don't know. But
I do feel like Vanderpool continuously like raises the bar in terms of his long distance soloing abilities, because I think I've said this before. I said this last week that I think his like 5 minute power is like literally the best. I think there's nobody better than him. But he's consistently getting better and better, or just showing us. Maybe it's always been there, but he's showing us more and more that he has the ability to do that for a little bit longer. Hold the really high power numbers for longer. Something that was maybe the province in my mind, at least, of Wout van Aert, who is this ace time trialist. Vanderpool hadn't had the same level of success as a time trialist, which is a different skill set in a way. I mean, your body's in a different position, but it is required of you to put down the power consistently for a long time. And he certainly did that at this race. Even when it seemed like that gap might close down, he did not falter, and he actually ended up finishing with quite a hefty gap to take the win in his second race back. You know, all the talk about Van Aert going to altitudes, you know, missing racing for a while to go train at altitude. Well, this is only Vanderpool's second race of the entire road season. So he too was ostensibly not coming in nearly as sharp or fresh as you might think. Didn't really seem to matter. He looked plenty sharp and fresh. Mm. You mentioned Lidl Trek and their race.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like we got a good moment of foreshadowing at the very end of the race when Stuyven finished second. Tom Skoinch finished in the top 10. And then just outside of the top 10 was Mads Pedersen. Actually, Alex Kirsch finished ahead of them. So they had four riders inside the top 11. And although Stuyven finished second, Pedersen didn't seem happy in the post-race interview.
There's two conditions where Mads Pedersen seems happy in a post-race interview. One, he wins the race. Two, the Tour de France is over. Those are the only I think it's amazing. I really love the way he is just very kind of blunt and absolute in his pre and post race interviews. I don't think he does it to be mean. I think he does it to be funny in a way that can come across as mean, especially when everyone's like, oh, you know, we'll take it day by day. And like, they will ask, you know, an easy teed up question. Like, you said you were the fittest of your life. Is that true? And he's like, I told you that on Thursday. Just use the audio from Thursday.
Yeah. he's very much that. I just said that and I had no more comments. Yep. What I found great about this particular post-race interview after E3 was that he said he and the team were happy with second place. That's a good performance for Jasper Stuyven. Mm-hmm. That was it. He didn't sound happy. That's what he said.
Yep.
But anyway, clearly comes out of E3 with
the best part was where the interviewer followed up and said, well, we're happy for Stuyven. How did you feel today? And he's like, I just told you I was happy.
Exactly.
On a day where he didn't look at his best. He didn't look at... I thought he was kind of riding off the back foot a little bit there. He really seemed not to be at his absolute best.
But, and that's less than a week after at Milano Sanremo, where Lidl Trek put all of their eggs in his basket. They backed him completely for the sprint. He was the guy, even though Jasper Stuyven had won Sanremo in the past, Pedersen was the guy at Milano Sanremo. So at Friday... at the end of Friday's race, I mean, this is a real low point, I think, for Pedersen personally. Even if his team looked pretty good, he's coming out of two races where he didn't really perform at the level that he wanted and that maybe a lot of people expected. And I think he's got an axe to grind after Friday's race. Mm. And as you put so beautifully when we were discussing, what is it that you described about one-day races versus stage races, coming into our planning process here?
As we will talk about when we get to Catalunya, that every stage race stage is chained irrevocably to the previous stage. Whereas multiple one-day races like Depana, E3, Gent-Wevelgem, you've got a fresh start every time. And so Vanderpool may have won E3 by 2 minutes, but that doesn't really matter at Gent-Wevelgem. It does a little bit. People know what they saw. They know how powerful he is. They know how he's riding. But he doesn't have 2 minutes in his back pocket to burn. Not necessarily that it was needed at Catalunya, but just that it was there and people had to plan around it. And Gent-Wevelgem, everybody starts at the same start line, finishes at the same finish line. The clock is basically irrelevant outside of those two facts.
It's a brand new clock. Yeah. The shot clock resets.
Mm-hmm. A new 24. That's right.
Exactly. And a whole new narrative can take place. And with that foreshadowing, let's take a quick break. So after Alpecin de Koenig won E3, making it three straight World Tour 1 days in a row, Sanremo, Brugge di Panna, E3, we got Gent-Wevelgem on Sunday. It was a windy, brisk morning in Flanders, and as predicted and hoped for, the wind played a role. What's the headline for this race?
It takes a village. I'm trying to get some sort of...
I like that.
I mean, it was definitely... You know, Matthew Vanderpool didn't win. Let's give that part away right now.
That's the headline, honestly.
Yeah. He tried. It was actually very similar. Very similar situations. 70, 80K out, where you had a lot of Trek riders and a Matthew Vanderpool. And Vanderpool basically tried to do what he did at E3, which was smash the field and let it regroup until he was tired of letting it regroup. And Trek really seemed to get just better position, more riders up. There's an attack over the Kemmelberg, ended up with two Trek riders, Jonathan Milan and Mads Pedersen with Vanderpool, kind of looking around as they're regrouping. Stalvin catches up. Jasper Stalvin from Trek, from Lidl Trek, catches up. And then immediately Milan is up the road, and Vanderpool is not shy. Just gets in a group. There's a couple other riders there, but he is doing a ton of work chasing him down. And kind of next time they hit the Kemmel, you'll see Pedersen hit him, and they get away with Lawrence Pithy. But it was very much a, like, get Vanderpool to do all the work you can possibly get him to do. Get into a selection with him. On the last passage of the Kemmel, Pedersen attacked, managed to get rid of Lawrence Pithy. It was just him and Vanderpool for the whole, what is it, last 30K of the race. They rode together pretty well. There's a little bit of jawing, maybe around 10K out. Two-up sprint. Vanderpool is sitting at the back because, you know, they're only about a minute up on the peloton. So if they start playing around, it's possible they could fall back to Philipsa. But Pedersen takes off pretty early, like 250 meters, and it's enough. He's also been riding at the front, kind of keeping the pace high, so Vanderpool's explosiveness doesn't come as much into play. Vanderpool tries to come around, and, I don't know, 100 meters, 75 meters, just, you know, stops pedaling. Like, he knows he can't get there, sits up. Pedersen brings it in for the win. Very much a better outcome for sure for Lidl Trek than at E3, but also kind of exposed some weaknesses in Vanderpool in terms of his belief in his own strength. Maybe more vulnerable to, you know, teamwork and tactics than you might want to admit.
I mean, especially when Philipsen is too far behind to, you know, factor in that very, very, in that finale. Yes, if they fully start playing games.
Well, I mean, Vanderpool could have done that, and he didn't do that, right? Like, that option was there from the moment they went clear to maybe a kilometer to go, maybe 300 meters to go. And it never seemed like Vanderpool was like, nah, I'm going to sit up. You're going to pull me all the way to the line. I'm going to go around you, or our team's going to catch you and we're going to get out sprinted. You know, Vanderpool always had that card and, you know, never fully sat up and sat on and said, you know, I am just going to sit on your wheel and try to pass you in the final 200 meters. If you don't want to do any more work, the group will catch us and my sprinter will probably win. He was committed to staying in that group, to staying clear. And I think he thought he could win, and it turned out he couldn't.
I think Trek's own same strategy of having a great sprinter behind probably put into that as well. I mean, if you're Alpecin de Kooning, I would think you are feeling pretty similarly about the chances of Vanderpool winning versus one other rider compared to Philipsen winning versus a bunch of other very good sprinters, including Jonathan Milan from Trek, who wasn't the only one there. There was also Olav Koy, who I think is one of the fastest in the world in a bunch sprint. Dylan Groenewegen and Tim Merlier, Binyam Girmay. I mean, a bunch of fast guys. Mm-hmm. So, you know, opposite to Koenig might have also, oh, Jordi Meus, who actually finished on the podium, I should say.
After doing a ton of work chasing too. So.
Yeah, he was constantly on the move, and yeah, really, really impressive day for him. So I think that might have factored in as well, which means, as you said, takes a village. I mean, having a sprinter option behind who also did work throughout the day really helped Mads Pedersen. And then in the end, he delivered. And that, I think, is a really big part of the win that shouldn't be overlooked, because he didn't deliver in the other chance that he had at San Remo. He didn't deliver. I mean, he didn't really even have a chance to deliver at E3. He wasn't in the mix, really. But 2 days later, as you said, I mean, it's a clean slate. Everybody starts on the same time. And Pedersen, the former world champion who has won this race before, Gent Wevelgem. So, you know, show this guy some respect, came through, delivered for the team.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see that Trek, there was a point where it really seemed like they had ridden themselves into maybe the situation they didn't want to be in. They had Jasper Stalvin flat, exactly where they didn't want him to flat, on the tiny little farm roads, where he couldn't get, basically he didn't even get his wheel change started until the pack was about to catch him. Jonathan Milan, as he was caught, was like visibly looking for a feed, I think for water, couldn't find it. And so you ended up with, instead of 3-on-1 against Vanderpool, you now had 1-on-1 against Vanderpool, which was, you know, I don't think necessarily what they started the day looking for, even as they started breaking up the field. And, you know, I'm sure they were on the radio trying to figure out how everyone was feeling. And they stuck with Pedersen after I'm going to say, not great performances by his standards. And he came through, which is cool to see. Like, both his performance and the team's faith in him to get it done.
Well, let's talk about that sprint, because going into the last 20 seconds of the race, I was skeptical of Peterson's positioning. And that is despite the fact that Escape Collective Editor-in-Chief Kaylee Fretz likes to say, when in doubt, lead it out, if you are uncertain of your chances in the sprint. And I'm just kind of curious, bike racing analyst extraordinaire Cosmo Catalano, why? Why is that better?
Because you have a whole bike. You have a whole bike that your opponent now has to make up on you, right? I mean, so you are starting one bike ahead. So you have that advantage.
You've got that. But then he has the advantage of having being able to ride in your slipstream, right? I mean,
yes and no. They're not coming into that sprint at threshold, right? Like this, for me, the delicate balance that Peterson has to strike is, how do I go fast enough that Vanderpool can't use that 0-60 that he has, that we've seen in a million cyclocross worlds, cyclocross races, cyclocross everything.
That's the thing they do in winter, right?
So he's coming out of a corner at crawling pace, and there's a 200 meter straightaway that he's going to ride as fast as he possibly can. And so he goes from, you know, walking pace to full sprint dozens of times a lap. And that is what he's really good at. We saw it at Crossworlds 2 years ago with Wout van Aert. Like, van Aert and Vanderpool came out of the final corner together onto pavement, and van Aert pauses for a second, and they are going pretty slow, and Vanderpool just accelerates. And there is no one in the peloton who can do that low speed to top speed as well as Vanderpool can. And so Peterson's got to keep the pace high enough that it isn't 0-60. It's like 45-60. Right, but at the same time, he can't go so hard that he's giving Vanderpool that armchair ride. Because the faster you go, the more advantage there is from drafting.
Yeah,
like physics. That for me was the balance.
At the end of the day, it worked. I mean, the reason I'm asking this question is that it worked. It worked well. And it looked like Vanderpool, as he often does, he was going all out trying to pass the rider in front of him, and then just blew up. And that's what he does. He just...
He also was racing in the wind for 30 kilometers more than Peterson was once they made that initial selection over the Kemmelberg. Like, that's a lot of work. And it wasn't like he was just rotating through. Some of the time he was, but other sections of time on those little plug strats, the little basically just packed down dirt, like, there isn't a lot of rotation. And so you come around a corner in the front, you're going to be on the front if you're riding with any pace until the next corner. It's very, that was a lot of energy he had to put into that. And 253 kilometers later, after 253 kilometers, 70 kilometers later, like, that adds up. That makes it really hard to go as fast as you can go. Not that, Peterson had an armchair ride, but at the same time, it's 30 kilometers of work he wasn't doing. I mean, he literally sat at the back of the field. He would be at the end of the rotation, talk to the guy who was coming back and say, no, you're going to go in front of me and I'm going to stay at the back.
Which, I mean, I'm impressed with that. I think that's key. And I think it also, I mean, at the very end of the race, if Vanderpool is tired, maybe he does have the ability to explode and do his thing for 2 or 3 seconds. But he, as we saw, did not have the ability to do it for 20. And that's, that's what Peterson did. He managed to.
And he's always liked long sprints too. That's the thing I think is actually hardest for him as a group sprinter, is it's hard to set him up right. Like, there's just so much other stuff. It's hard to get a group sprint aligned where he wants it. Whereas a two-up sprint, I think, is a little more his cup of tea. He has a little more control over when he wants to go, over what other people do. There's only one other person, right? So way fewer variables.
Yeah. And in the end, this was a great example of all of his abilities as a rider kind of coming together, because we've seen him win bunch sprints. That is something he could do, even if he has a certain style that might not jive with bunch sprints as easily as an Olav Kooi. He also is, he's a classics guy. He's won this race before. He's won a world championship. He can do a long race, and Gent-Wevelgem is a long race. It's 250K, not super long compared to San Remo, but it's certainly longer than I've ever ridden at a World Tour level.
It was interesting to see him really try and temper expectations ahead of next weekend. He was very much like, oh, you know, that's a really different race. This is a better race for me. So I don't really know how to read that. I don't know how to read that. he was quite specific about it.
I think it's a, generally, I think it's a good tactic to be that way. It worked out well for Contador for a long, like, I feel like Contador loved to play down his chances. Mm-hmm. Or like,
no, I don't like that climb. The climb's not good for me.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sick. And I think in general, that's a good strategy to have people not looking at you, unless you really want to cultivate the, you know, we got to trademark this, the aura of invincibility, you know, the Tadej Pogacar frighten everyone into submission. That's the other end of the spectrum. I guess they can both work. Speaking of Pogacar, I think one of my takeaways, this is something that might be more of a placeholders topic, but I'll just kind of tee it up here. Maybe we'll talk about it elsewhere later this week, but I like that Mads Pedersen won this race. I think it was good. I think it's good for the race. I think it's good for cycling in general that Pedersen can win this, that Mateo Jorgensen can win Paris-Nice. There are cycling media outlets today that use this term, the big six, which is not a completely inaccurate way of characterizing the men's World Tour peloton right now, in that Pogacar, Vingegaard, Roglic, Evenepoel, Van Aert, and Vanderpool, those six riders do seem to be a cut above all of the rest. And if you watched Catalunya, we'll talk about it in a bit, or if you watched Tirreno Adriatico, if you watched Strade Bianche, you would have seen when the rest of the big six skip a race and only one or two of them go, it can be so dominant as to be less exciting. And so I like it when Mateo Jorgensen can win a Paris-Nice, or when a Mads Pedersen, who's, again, not like some schmo. He's not a nobody. He's a former world champion.
He is actually higher in the UCI rankings than Vanderpool is right now, in part because Vanderpool hasn't raced very much. But
yeah.
Worth noting.
Yeah. I do think, though, that most people would put Vanderpool higher on the likelihood of winning a big race.
Yes. You know?
And yet, Pedersen won this race, you know, won it fair and square. He won it in a sprint against Vanderpool. So he won it, you know, with his power. And I like that. I like that it keeps things a little more interesting.
Pushing back on the big six. I don't like this, like...
I don't love it either.
But at a certain point, like, you're not going to be able to draw lines anymore, right? It's going to be
at a certain point,
six.
The number's too big.
Well, exactly. And you're overlooking that Jasper Philipsen has won San Remo and Japan.
Again, like, I'm saying
I know
there are outlets.
I'm saying that I think it's kind of silly. I think it also kind of oversells stage racing. It oversells kind of this, not that, you know, Van Aert and Vanderpool are stage racers, but it kind of, I think that, I want to say predictability, but I think the law of averages over time in a stage race will deliver you more reliably a big name winner. Whereas one day racing really encapsulates that, what I think is quite excellent part of cycling, where the right person in the right move at the right time can win the race regardless of any other factors.
Totally. Which makes one day racing so awesome. It makes the fact that my favorite bike race in the world being 7 days away is so awesome. I'm going to be there. I cannot wait. Oh, all right. One last thing about Gent-Wevelgem on the men's side. Is Sudal Quickstep like racing right now?
They put a lot of work in today. They did a lot of work and got, you know, nothing out of it.
Merlier finished eighth. That's what they got out of it.
I don't know. I mean, Merlier, I think at one point he was pretty isolated. I'm trying to remember if I'm misremembering now. But, I mean, there was – Casper Asgreen definitely spent the most time on the front of anybody pedaling hard. It just happened to be in a group that wasn't really contesting the win. I don't know what the deal is. I think anybody sane would have seen Trek go to the front the way they did going into the Kemmelberg and would have said, you better be there. Someone's got to be there. Someone's got to be watching this move. And they weren't. And they're plenty strong. They've got tons of strong guys. I don't know what the missing ingredient is.
And to be a little bit more accurate, I should say, like, where is Sudal Quickstep? First of all, they did finish second at Brugge de Panne with Merlier, but actually, the real question you should... E3, though, that was the real, like, where... Yves Lampard was their highest finisher in 28th.
Yeah.
And I think I saw someone say that was their worst finish at this race in their history.
I would believe that.
It just certainly feels like... I feel like whenever this comes up in the last 2 years or so, people talk about how Quickstep has really declined from the Bonen years, which... One, yeah, but two, it's not just
Bonen. The years were 20 years ago,
it's not,
right?
It really annoys me when I hear it because, Gilbert, Terpstra...
Postal's really fallen off since the Lance Armstrong
exactly,
era. Come on.
This team was damn good. Kasper Asgreen looked like he was going to be the Flanders guy, till pretty recently. It's not just the Bonen year. This was a really good team with some really good riders. Terpstra, Gilbert, and Asgreen being the ones who won the most, but Yves Lampaert, the guy that I just mentioned, pretty darn good as well. And yet, for all of the success they had not that long ago, not just the Bonen years, not that long ago, suddenly they've really fallen off with most of that, most of the core of, Asgreen and Ed Lampaert. A lot of those guys who were winning are still there. So it's just kind of strange. It really feels like, Asgreen had a crash and it does not seem as if he has recovered and reached that same level since then. In the past year, and the rest of the team has just kind of consistently underperformed. Maybe Merlier will help them get back to some of their stronger results in the sprints. But, Julian Alaphilippe, not that long ago, we were talking about how exciting it was that he was going to be racing the Tour of Flanders.
He was in the picture at E3. He was not in the picture, I think, when you wanted to be in the picture. I think he was... he's a guy who races on spirit, right? He attacks when he feels like it's the right time to attack. And, maybe it's because he knows he can't attack when everyone else is attacking anymore. But he's up there. He's like, for me, it's more like, why wasn't Asgreen up at the front in the Kemmel? Like, he's strong enough to be in that group, to ride in that group. He's stronger than Laurens Pithy. Like, all respect to Pithy for, at 21, being fearless about following anybody into any move at the front of one of these classics. But, a guy like Kasper Asgreen could really do damage up there. Not that Pithy isn't doing damage, but your Sudal Quickstep, you got to have someone there, and they just haven't. And I don't know why that is.
I mean, the door is open for someone to step up, clearly.
To quote Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog, the fish rots from the head.
Ooh. Yeah,
maybe
we
that's,
can leave it there.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, let's take a break. All right, that was Men's Gent Wevelgem. We have plenty to say about Catalunya, but before we do, what's the headline from the Women's Gent Wevelgem?
Oh man. Stage set for epic sprint battles for the remainder of the season. It was great. It was a really great sprint. Came down to a bike throw between Lorena Vivas, who we expect to win these things, and Elisa Balsamo, who has been at the top level, was not quite there, but looked really good. Trek set her up really well. Esteworks obviously set up pretty well. Yeah, I think Vivas is kind of, in a similar vein to Capecchi, her kind of branching out into being a more complete rider has taken a little bit off the top of her sprint. And I think we, the cycling viewer, are going to be the beneficiary because, that was just a beautiful, tight, just perfect sprint. Loved watching it.
Very close.
Yeah. So, yeah.
And I think just to look back at the last few women's World Tour races, your winners are Vivas, Balsamo, Balsamo, Vivas. And so, to further bolster your point, we are being treated to a real showdown. And I'm in a similar vein to how I was happy with Elisa Balsamo's Trek teammate, Mads Petersen, winning. I was happy to see Elisa Balsamo win Brugge de Panne because on the women's side, there is a dominance, not of a so-called big six, but of a singular team. And it's nice when Elisa Balsamo and Marianne Vos sometimes, break up that dominance by the team of Lorena Vivas, who did win Gent Wevelgem, SD Works. I'm thinking we're going to have plenty more discussion of the busy week of racing on the women's side on Wheel Talk. So tune in for Wheel Talk. Abby will have more this week. That'll be up the day after this show goes up. All right, that was the classics. We are just less than a week away from the Tour of Flanders. It's very exciting. We'll get back to that in a bit. But before we do, let's shift gears and talk about stage races, because there was a stage race over in Catalonia, or Catalunya as the locals call it, where Tadej Pogacar was present and accounted for.
The Volta a Tadej Pogacar.
Pretty much.
Powered by Tadej Pogacar.
Yeah, is that the headline? That seems like a pretty good headline.
Pretty much, yeah. Nick Schultz did not get the memo on stage one.
I loved Nick Schultz doing his thing on stage one. And we'll get to that in a sec. But yeah, in terms of the headline, Tadej Pogacar won not only the overall by an obscene margin for a one-week stage race with not that much like high mountain activity. He also won four stages. Three of those were, you know, serious
traditional
climbs.
Tadej Pogacar fare.
And then the last one in Barcelona, which is a hard day. I mean, there's a lot of accumulated climbing, but it's just they keep going over the Montjuïc climb, which is less than 3K at less than 5% average. So
it's a good world circuit, kind of.
It is a great world circuit. And I think Pogacar in this particular, and so on this final stage, made it a little bit more interesting for us and just won it in an interesting way. His team, actually, I think Joao Almeida helped out a lot for UAE. So yeah, it wasn't just a dominant stage race GC performance, in which he won by more than three and a half minutes over Mikel Landa.
You know, the last stage was a sprint. That was a legit sprint. It was only 22 people, it was a sprint. Hands down.
Bolstering the view of one Kaylee Fretz that maybe sprinting at Milano Sanremo is his best chance, which I continue to come around on that.
I don't know. How long was that last stage? Was that 300? No, it was not. It was 145.
He's got to do that twice. Mm. Yeah. So Pogacar won handily in the GC. Mikel Landa second. Egan Bernal third. Briefly, can you tell us how this race was won, the GC at least?
UAE doing stage race things and Pogacar being super strong. I think a lot of his rivals were a little flat. I think we wanted to see more from Sepp Kuss and maybe even Chan Otterbrooks for Visma Lisa bike. But we, unlike the stage races, like once you get that, what was it, minute and a half gap he had after stage, Pogacar had after stage two, you stop trying to beat the guy and you start looking in your rearview mirror and worrying about the guys behind you trying to beat you. I don't necessarily think it was bad. Necessarily, I don't think we got less racing than we might have otherwise had in terms of competitiveness. I think we saw some cool battles between a resurgent Egan Bernal and Mikel Landa. But yeah, Pogacar won this bike race and it was never in doubt. And even after he had basically had the GC sewn up, was still going after it. Maybe there's just on the inside of his glasses, there's an etching of Jonas Vingegaard to keep him motivated, to keep him attacking.
Yeah. Not the kind of rider who is going to take his minute and a half early lead and then just sit on it. You know, if there's a stage to be won, he's going to go try to win it. And that's what he did. He kept attacking from really far out on the mountain stages. And then on that final stage, which ended up, as we said, in a sprint, he found a way to win that too. Before we get to that, Nick Schultz put on a show on stage one. That was fantastic. That was a stage where you saw a rider using a couple of different things. I mean, he used
the thing that happened and then do the...
Yeah. What did happen?
Nick Schultz, late attack, or late catch. Late catch coming into the last kilometer. Looked like he was going to get caught. Did not get caught.
Yeah, he was on the front. There was sort of like one of those sort of, oh, I'm on the front. Oh, it's not that far to the finish line. Maybe I'll just attack. Okay. And there you go. He held on. Tadej Pogacar, with about 200 meters to go, maybe. The chasing group trying to chase down Schultz tried to close him down, wasn't getting close enough for Pogacar, so he just took matters into his own hands and attempted to do a solo bridge, and he got really close. And I loved the way that Schultz described it afterward. He said it was a bullet shot out of the peloton, because he really was closing with impressive speed, mm-hmm. but he did not close in time, and Schultz got the win. And it was a great example of a rider using the race situation, the fact that in that situation, he knows that he's got, first of all, he's on the front of the peloton. He's got that small advantage of being at the front. You know, those are bike lengths that other people have to make up, as you described in a long sprint. But also, nobody wants to chase down Nick Schultz in the first few seconds. You know, they're all looking at Tadej Pogacar. And Tadej Pogacar doesn't want to chase down Nick Schultz because he wants to save the energy to face everybody else. And by the time people work out what's happening, it's too late. And a rider like Nick Schultz, who, you know, I think we're being sufficiently respectful to Nick Schultz by praising him for doing this, that I can also say he's not exactly somebody who wins a lot of bike races. And so for him to be able to do this is just a testament to his savvy. This was his first ever World Tour win. He's 29 years old, and he made it happen with form and also just really good race craft.
Yeah, and there's always the tradition of, like, no one else in the picture win is the best win. I am a big fan of 0 second gap to the people who didn't quite catch you, eclipsing totally. You after you cross the line because you got it done. Like, that, for me, is the coolest way to win a bike race.
Yeah, when you're the only one, like, that gives the photographer enough time to take a bunch of shots so that the lighting can be perfect. And we saw some of those of Tadej Pogacar this week. Saw one from him just looking really well lit, like it was a studio shot, just at the finish line. I was very impressed with it. But, you know, that happens when you kind of are prepared. This is different, and I like it even more, as you say. I mean, it's a way more entertaining, you know, way to finish. So thank you for doing that, Nick Schultz, for putting on a show in the stage battles. It was the very next day that Pogacar got his lead that would prove unassailable. But I will say that, as I've kind of been hinting at, that final stage win for Pogacar, I was really entertained as well. You know, on the other stages, he was just putting these blistering long-range mountain attacks that nobody could catch. Landa, Bernal, other riders. Landa was the one who came closest, which is not close at all, but he came closest to...
3 minutes and 41 seconds.
Yeah. To being able, he was consistently second, at least, on these stages. But yeah, on that last stage, different story. It did end in a sprint, and UAE used Joao Almeida as a late attack, and that helped set up Pogacar for what would be a sprint. And I was impressed with the way they pulled that off. It reminded me of what Uno X has done a couple times, unsuccessfully so far this year. But it forced other teams to make the chase. And then Pogacar could focus on a sprint, like a full-on real sprint with, not many other big-name fast finishers there. But he pulled it off, got that final stage win, and beat Dorian Godin, Guillaume Martin, and, got the fourth win of the race. I don't want to say that he's over-heralded, but my last takeaway personally from Catalunya is about a sprinter, actually. It's that Brian Cocar really does not like... to win World Tour races.
It's an interesting way to put it.
Yeah, he must have a real aversion to it. Obviously, that's probably not true. I'm sure he would love to win more of them. But he has, Joe Lindsay looked this up, he's won more than 50 professional races in his time. One of them is a World Tour win. And at this race, Volta Catalunya,
and
where...
the World Tour win, was it... what month was it in?
I don't know. I think
it was in January.
Are you
I'm just saying,
suggesting
it was
that
the
a World
win,
Tour race...
The win was in January.
Are you suggesting that
sport.
A World Tour race in the same country as
I'm,
many of our
I'm
fine
just
listeners?
I'm saying it was in January, and the biggest races in cycling are not in January. That's all I'm saying.
I don't want to touch that, you know? I have too much respect for our friends, for antipodal...
It is not a geographical distinction. I'm very specific.
Yeah.
I said month.
A seasonal thing.
Temporal, yes.
You make a fine point, sir. That's the only time Cocar has ever won a World Tour race. And if you look at the start list, there were two sprint stages at this race. And if you look at the start list, I'm thinking Brian Cocar goes into this race and he and his team are like, yes, I finally get to get some World Tour wins. Because look at this, the rest of this field, there's kind of not that many big names, like really... No top-tier sprinters at this race.
In general, I would actually say the field was a little bit weaker than I would have expected. But maybe that's is that a placeholders discussion?
That might be a placeholders thing. Yeah. It is true, though. I mean, if you look back at Volta's Catalunya past, in general, I think you will find very much that that's true. But in the sprinter department, your two sprint winners were, well, other than Tadej Pogacar, Marijn Vandenberg of EF and Axel Lawrence of Alpecin de Koenig, who, yet again, proving that they are the former Pro Conti team du jour, du an, du, I don't know, decade. I don't know what that word is in French, but they're pretty good for being a recently Pro Conti team. And yet, Brian Cocard, on his recently Pro Conti team of Cofidis, not really delivering. Fourth and third in the two sprints here. So I'm sorry if that sounds mean, Brian Cocard. I want you to do well. You seem like a nice fellow. I wish nothing but the best for you at the rest of your season. But I also expected more from you in this race. All right. Odds and ends.
Bits
any
and
other,
pieces. No.
Any other big thoughts for you?
Classics are awesome. Maybe there Catalonia are. Should break itself into like a series of four hilly stage races and see if they can get more riders there. I don't know. I don't know necessarily if Pogacar would win all of those races by the same.
I would
same.
Think not. Even Pogacar, you know,
yeah.
sometimes doesn't win like at Milan San Remo and the Tour de France the last 2 years.
Fair.
Yeah. All right. Classics are awesome. So let's close with some classics talk. We have some classics coming up. Before the Tour of Flanders is Dwars door Vlaanderen.
Mm. Across Flanders.
Yeah. They go across it and then they go around it. That's on Wednesday. Jasper Philipsen back at that race. Mads Pedersen back at that race. Wout van Aert at that race. Expectation being that Mathieu van der Poel not going to be at that race. But, you know, with Jasper Philipsen, they still have a heck of a team. For now, I think Christophe Laporte is slated to go, and that's a big talking point for me for the races coming up. Visma Lisa Bike has been flat the last couple of big
by their
races.
Standards. By their standards.
By their standards. Again, and this is classic specific. Jonas Vingegaard has not been flat, but the classic squad has been flat. Christophe Laporte was just not good at San Remo. He was not at either race this weekend, and I think they need him to be healthy at his best for them to have that dominance.
I feel like I heard he was sick.
Yeah, he was. So. Yep. And you know, I hope he's recovered because I think it helps make for a better race when that team has multiple options. It helps my fake team that we drafted a couple weeks ago for placeholders. Anyway, Dwars is on Wednesday. That's the men's side. We're going to potentially see another Alpecin Visma Little Trek battle.
Should mention that Tratnik, now that I think of it, because Tratnik had a concussion, I think, today.
Yeah, he abandoned Gent-Wevelgem.
Yep. Which is too bad, because he's an extremely useful rider for them.
And extremely successful this year after having won with that news spot.
True. It's their most decorated classics rider of the year for them.
That's actually, yeah. All right, on the women's side, there is a Dwars. It is not a World Tour race, but there will still be, you know, plenty of big names there for all intents and purposes. All those big World Tour squads are there, as far as I can tell. I think Elisa Balsamo, though, I don't know if she is going to be at that race. But that's the middle of the week. The big one is on Sunday, the Tour of Flanders. The
Super Bowl.
I think it's the biggest race in Belgium, which is, you know, the most cycling mad country on the planet, right?
I think it is most correctly referred to as the biggest bike race in the world. The Tour de France is big, but the Tour de France is 21 days. 30-something if you count, 29 if you count the women's. That's a lot of days to divide bigness over, I think, in terms of the most bike racing in one day in one place. It's tough to challenge the magnitude of the Ronde van Vlaanderen.
And the wonderfulness. But, yeah, and the fan
atmosphere. You would know better than I know.
I've gone a few times and it's just always amazing. There's really no other way to, it's just amazing. It's a really awesome environment. The Belgian fans are just, it's cool to go from a place, well, and there's a bummer of an element here coming from the US where bike racing is like really struggling on the road side, at least. To attract fans, well, to even exist.
yes, accurate.
Go to Belgium and they treat it like it's like the way that a lot of American sports towns treat their football teams. And it's just a really special experience. And we should be treated to a special battle because Wout van Aert and Mathieu van der Poel are going to be there. Mats Pedersen is going to be there to hopefully prove that he belongs in this conversation and that these outlets who are not including him in their big six are wrong. And there's a lot of other riders too who are going to hopefully challenge the Visma Lisa Bike Alpecin de Koenig Little Trek hegemony. Maybe Sudal Quickstep will even get involved. Maybe. Who knows?
Put Casper Asman in the break. I mean, this is
not much to lose at this point, right?
Yeah. I feel like he was way up the road for a long time in one of these a few years ago. I think
he was also way up the road when he won.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Pedersen also had a big I think he was second in like 2018 or 2019. And was up the road for like 60 kilometers or something
It was an early big result for him that really suggested that this guy might be a legit rider we should pay attention to. And that proved to be true. That's the men's side. Women's side, you've got Wiebes and Vollering for SD Works.
I'm really excited to see how Wiebes performs on a course this hilly and this punchy.
I want to know what they're planning to do with Wiebes, Vollering, and returning defending champion Lotta Kopecky.
They got to be riding for Kopecky, right?
I really want Danny Stam one of these days to go into this race like this and say, "It's going to be fun if we just race each other. Just do it. Why not? You know, as long as everybody involved is okay with it.
The Belgian world champion." In the rainbow
I'm not
stripes.
Saying it's ever going to happen. I'm just saying it'll be fun.
This is not the race for the fun. This is the race for the winning. This is the big
if
show.
If not
right
this,
here.
Then where?
Brabant Pale? I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. Okay. Point being though, as long as everyone involved is okay with it, you know, it's not cool when it's like you go halfway through a race and then that suddenly changes. I'm talking about the Vuelta, but I'm fine with it if you're going to go into it with that in mind. Anyway, we'll see how they decide to play their hand there, and we'll see if anybody else can challenge them at the Tour of Flanders. That's on Sunday, and when that race is over, Cosmo Catalano and I will reconvene to tell you how it was won.
How the race was won.
Which is the name of this podcast, and I'm Dane Cash, and you are?
Cosmo Catalano.
And we'll see you next week.